Okay, welcome to Discovery 2, Module 10. And we will be doing a revision of the various things we've covered in Discovery. And we will also be talking about some various issues that students may have that they may have raised. Okay, now, has anybody yet been on the Curtin Remote Bundle? Has anybody tried logging in and telnetting in? I spoke about it a few weeks ago.
Not yet.
Not yet, but Dean gave me a very quick introduction to it about a year ago, and that was about it.
Okay, well, that's not so bad. Well, I mean, you won't be so bad. You two should be okay, given that you guys have at least used TerraTerm before and have the JAWS scripts.
Yep, it's all sweet.
Okay. All right. Now, so basically, Discovery 2 covers basically an introduction to how the ISP operates, what the ISP responsibility is, what the customer responsibility is, how to do help desk and all that sort of good stuff. In other words, how to talk to the help desk and how to be on the end of the help desk. It also covers, I'm just going to alt-tab to get rid of my MSN window here. There we are. Just asking somebody about SPF, and they just replied to me, so I've just got rid of them. Okay, and it also talks about the very simple aspects of router setup and configuration. Booting up routers, shutting them down, all of those sorts of things. And it gives you a broad overview of the introductory level router stuff that is involved in setting up the ISP level routers. Now, does anybody have any questions that they would like to ask on the stuff that has been covered in Discovery 2? And if they don't have any questions on Discovery 2, we can cover general sorts of questions, and I can talk about that IP masking thing that you were talking about in a minute if we don't have any other questions.
No questions here.
Alrighty. Now, you were asking, Elise, about subnet masks of 255.255.255.255. Why would you get one of those on a PPP link? The answer to that question is there is only one other destination IP address for a PPP link, and that address is not your machine. So any packet that's sent out over a PPP link has to go to the other end of it because there's nowhere else it can go.
Uh-huh. Yeah, of course. So that IP address that I'm handed by my ISP isn't my... Obviously, it's not the IP address of my machine, is it? Yeah.
The IP address that's being handed to you by your ISP is the IP address of your machine. But the fact is that when a packet is sent over a PPP link from your machine, it comes from the IP address you were handed, but it gets shoveled out over the ISP, and the ISP sees that it comes from a particular IP address, and the ISP already has the routes in place to deal with that.
Fair enough.
So what we used to do was that we used to have one address on either end of a point-to-point link, and in fact... the point-to-point links that I've got have got one IP address for the end of the DSLAM, and the other one is the actual PC. And so when you send your packets out, they go to the DSLAM, and then the DSLAM takes care of routing them out to the rest of the internet.
Yep.
But to conserve IP addresses further, they only use one IP address, and then you actually run the link in what we call unnumbered mode. So basically a packet comes in from the internet, it's destined for... one of the 110 addresses you've been assigned, it's routed through to the access concentrator. The access concentrator then has a table that says, I know what PPP machines are on which IP addresses, and it just shovels the packets down to that single address. So you don't actually need to know what the other end of the link is actually hooked to, because all of your packets are going to go to the concentrator no matter what.
Mm-hmm. And this concentrator that you're speaking of now, which is a new term for me, is this is back at the ISP's end?
Well,
or is it in the DSLAM?
It's DSLAM, concentrator, whatever your dial-in point, whatever you want to call it. I mean, I refer to something that actually takes a whole lot of ports and multiplexes them together onto one communications medium. So that'll be, and I believe if you're running 2+, you're actually on TPGs DSLIMs?
Yeah, I'm running 2+. I'm on TPG's DSLIM, yeah.
Okay. So if you're in Australia...
And so too is Will.
Yeah, that's right. Well, in Australia, if you run ADSL 2, you're often on Telstra's DSLAMs. If you're running 2+, you're running the DSLIMs that belong to the ISPs.
Indeed. And the interesting thing about all this is that Will moved over to the TPG infrastructure about a month prior to me. He was always on TPG, but he was, as you said, running on the Telstra's DSLAM because he only had ADSL 2. And when he moved across in May, he noticed this 110 address, and we went, oh, that's rather interesting. Of course, I came across from another ISP to TPG about a month later, but the net result was the same. I wound up on the infrastructure or the DSLAM of TPG, and I noticed the same thing. Oh, this is curious. These 110 addresses are given out all over the place. Some IP to world web type things still think Will and I are in England, which we're not, because some of them have got it right now. They're catching up.
Well, I mean, as the globalisation proceeds, I mean, you can't, IP addresses and stuff get reallocated and stuff. But because we are experiencing such an IP shortage, it's in the interests of the ISPs to conserve as many IP addresses as possible. And you're lucky they haven't gone to the step that some ISPs have gone to, and that's actually putting their users behind a network address translator, and that is quite unpleasant.
Oh, whoa. That would... that scares me.
Well, just imagine, you can't receive any external incoming connections, you can't run any web servers or SSH servers or stuff, because you're behind a network address translator and you're not getting incoming packets. The ISPs argue that as a home user, you shouldn't need to receive any incoming connections.
Oh, yeah, and I could see those two big large ISPs that people often go with in Australia would probably do that for that argument. Having said that, though...
In America, half of them do it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised for what Kerry said. But no, I did look through the TPG do's and don'ts and frequently asked questions before I joined them, and that was one of the questions: can I run a server? Yes, they said you may. Beware, of course, if your internet connection goes down, your server will not be available to the internet, which is pretty duh. And that's it, the only comment they made. So they do encourage it, at least for the moment, anyway.
Yes, however, some of the other ISPs actively discourage it to prevent...
Well, basically,
well, in a way, I mean, it's small home office, you know, small office home office users that want to do their web server on the cheap. Maybe hosting it on the DSL is a reasonable solution for them. For example, we have a non-profit organisation, vizhelp.org. Don't bother going to their website at the moment because it's currently broken. And they really don't have an operating budget to spend $20 a month on a web presence. So running a web server on a home DSL connection is certainly an option for them.
Oh, for sure. And Will's often been at me for my clients to do it. I won't do it. A, on principle, and B, what Will doesn't appreciate is that all the hits to the various websites that I'm hosting, you know, like professionally, would chew up my uplink. So it's not really a good idea, and I would just rather have it, you know, handed on to the people I'm with at the moment who have a data centre and it all backed up and nice big fat pipeline to the internet and everyone has their website on 24/7 and it's all cool.
Well, I think that's a valid argument. And one of the things I've learnt about hosting things on your home DSL connection, and this is partially relevant to lecture, so we'll talk about it anyway, is that once you have half the infrastructure for somewhere on your home networks, you then become responsible for the infrastructure. And, for example, keeping the mailing lists up and running was certainly an infrastructure decision that I had to... look at, and the continuity and stability of those mailing lists. The other problem that we tended to experience was that I purchased a what we call a mail hop account for relaying of outbound emails, and one post to one of our mailing lists will use up 150 of my 200 a day email quota, so you don't want to relay through MailHop if you're hosting mailing lists. So that should all go away soon as we move the mailing lists across onto the new servers that I don't have to care about. But it is a very important thing to keep in mind that if you are going to run services and host servers and stuff, you then have a responsibility or a perceived responsibility to keep those resources available as often as possible. And people will start giving you unintentionally a hard time if certain resources stop being available. Where is that stuff that is on your server, for example? And you can't blame them, because I mean it's a server, but it does mean you do take on a lot of responsibility making those available yourself.
I totally agree, and I think, you know, in the, you know, how many years Cabby's been going now, you've done a sterling job of that, and I don't think the organisation could have gotten by without your knowledge and your goodwill to make those services available. But yes, it is on a domestic DSL link, which I think is symmetric, so you don't have the upload speed, and of course there's all these limitations that, as you say, that you're going to get caught with. So, but it, you know, Cabby, it's like anything, it had to start somewhere. And without your input in that respect, it wouldn't have happened. It's now time to grow and you know, move on to a more appropriate link, which I can see is happening. So, yeah, it's the same thing. People don't appreciate the differences between a domestic-grade home office, small office connection, which is, say, what you and I are talking about now, for both your setup and my setup, to a more professional wider band, always on, etc. system that that professional people need. So, oh yes, sure. If you go to lonsdalemedia.org, http://www.lonsdalemedia.org, you will find a web page there with a very simple thing on it, just for something to do, which comes off Challenger, and that's it. It's not a professional website. lonsdalemedia.com.au, however, is hosted in the data centre.
I think one of the things that we also discussed,
as far as always on, the email comes here though, but anyway, sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, as to always on, that's debatable. When it rains, the lines fill up with water and the modem loses line sync, but theoretically fairly often available.
One of the interesting problems, you too, I get that too, yes.
Ah, you have that problem as well, do you? When it rains, the ADSL sort of goes up and down?
Yep, with TPG, it didn't happen so much, or I didn't notice it so much with Hotkey, but I suspect that's because the ADSL 2 protocols, etc., are a lot more sensitive to this sort of stuff.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Probably impedance mismatches or something. I'm not exactly sure of the technical reasons for it. But one of the problems we're now having is even with the 2 megabit link, there are people who insist on mirroring the internet, and usually that involves mirroring our web server, and once they start hammering our web server, we see incredible ventrilo delays and start seeing packet dropouts. So even on the commercial link, we're actually looking at methods of throttling our outbound web traffic to stop it from overwhelming our link.
Yes, I think we discussed this briefly last week, because, you know, at the end of the day, when this other website goes up and it's pitched towards the encouraging in of new students and the corporate sponsorships and stuff, we need to have that going all the time. So, you know, like at the moment, it's been rather cool. Oh, let's just shut down the web server because we've got a lecture going. But with the, you know, the branding and stuff that's going to happen, that's probably not going to be so appropriate. So, yes, the throttling will be good for the periods that you're experiencing bandwidth issues.
Well, yeah. I mean, interestingly enough, we actually have a lot of complaints from the US students that our site isn't fast enough. It only goes at 200k a second. And we sort of have to say to people, patience.
It's like, what are you downloading, you know?
200k a sec is probably by American standards slow, but you know, I know people on what we would call ADSL 1 connections in the US, you know, like the 1500 speed. So, you know, Australia does have that pretty bad reputation, which let's hope after a few years of NBN, if it ever happens, we will hopefully be able to shrub off.
If 200k is not that bad.
Oh, it's pretty good.
I usually offer for them to pay our bandwidth bill. That usually quiets them down a bit.
Stops them down a bit. Oh, look, if you know, eventually, you know, and it gets back to money and funding and resources and all that sort of stuff, Cavi might, you know, the next step up from what you've got now, let's say we've moved from a domestic link with their email lists and stuff from Kerry's Goodwill, we're up on the association now, and the next step would be a data centre. But, yeah, that all costs money and funding and et cetera, and that's, you know, not quite where we're at the moment. It's good that we've got. It's good that we've gone as far as we have. It really isn't such a short time.
Yeah, exactly. So that's some operational issues and all that sort of good stuff. So we'll certainly see how all that goes, and we'll look into sort of sorting all that out in the long term, and move those mailing lists across at some point. I have to bring the TAR-GZs across and test the mailing list infrastructure. Okay, so as far as Discovery 2 is concerned, as far as I can tell, Chapter 10 is basically the review for the CCENT practice exams. And there are two of them that you can take, which is the Cisco Certified Entry-Level Network Technician. So as far as Chapter 10 is concerned, there isn't actually a lot of lecturing to be done. I would recommend that if people want to do a good revision of the module, that they either run back and listen to the lectures again, or go back and read over the chapter summaries, and make sure that none of the points in the chapter summary confuse them too much, and if they do, to go back and read that section in the curriculum. That's usually how I revise the notes, just have a quick whip through the summary and then come back and read the rest of the notes if I don't actually remember one of the points that's raised. Alrighty, well, I think we're essentially done for Module 10. I'm just going to stop recording, and then if anybody else has got anything else specifically they want to talk about, we can certainly do that. Otherwise, that'll be it for today.